Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. After a week off for my birthday, I know I don't look a day older than 46, I am back, but Thea is, alas, away from the office with some sort of consumptive illness. And you know, people think that literary journalists are weak things, constantly coughing into their silk handkerchiefs as they lie abed, having high-minded thoughts, and they are absolutely right. It's like the magic mountain in the TLS most days. But happily, bravely struggling on, perhaps because she doesn't get contaminated by literary fatigue as she does not read the newspaper, is indie pop star and francophone, even francophile, Lucy Dallas.
Hello.
Hello, Lucy. Are you feeling well?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm in rude health. I'm not having any high-minded thoughts at all.
Good. Well, let's try and keep that way over the next 35 minutes or so.
Yeah.
If we can survive. We're having a spring sale at the TLS at the moment. If you Google TLS spring sale, you can get 95% off our subscription price for a couple more weeks. Coming up on the show today, Americans, eh? You can't live with them, but they control the whole world. But can we British ever understand them and vice versa? Author Lionel Shriver has reviewed a new book on the tangled relationship between English and American English, and will be on the line to tell us more. Now, if I say the name Simon Lays, how much would you know about him? Not that much, if you are me, although Lucy is, I am sure, a towering expert on his life. Lucy.
That's not exactly how I would phrase it.
Towering expert?
No, I would never say that.
What would you say?
Very, very humble. I'd say I've heard of him.
Yep.
And you know a little bit.
You know a little bit. Well, thankfully, David Coward is on hand to fill in the blanks about this Belgian academic who became the scourge of those intellectuals who were soft on Mao. And we have a new poem by Kate Bingham called This Hair, which is well worth listening to. As is common with many notable quotations, George Bernard Shaw's quip that Britain and America are two countries divided by a common language is not found in his printed works and attributed to him only in tendentious fashion. Oscar Wilde did, in his short story The Canterville Ghost from 1887, have his narrator say something broadly similar. We have really everything in common with America nowadays except, of course, language. The sentiment has passed into axiom. Lionel Shriver this week wisely avoids this particular literary turf war in her review of Lynn Murphy's book The Prodigal Tongue, written partially to question the commonly held British view that American English is an invasive species that will choke and supplant the native word life. There is a word for such a sneer which I shall now mispronounce, amerilexidophobia. And as Shriver, who speaks fluent English and American, points out, such an attitude is often misplaced. Sidewalk is a piece of early 17th century English, for example, and fall, used to mean that season of mellow fruitfulness, is of a similar pedigree. Both are squeamishly held by many British people to be the product of America. In contradistinction, Americans fondly attribute quaint, eccentric-sounding words to their snaggletooth cousins from across the Atlantic. A bumbershoot is an American word for an umbrella, though doesn't sound it. Poppycock sounds like something Samuel Johnson would have harumphed gouttily into his port, but is Dutch for doll's poop, brought by settlers from the Netherlands to North America. Don't get me started on the word poop. though. Lionel Shriver is here to tell us more. Lionel, welcome.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Let's start. Is there a snobbishness, do you think, a sort of prejudice against American English?
Yes, the British are very attached to it. They think their pronunciation is superior. They think their vocabulary choices are superior. But the funny thing is, there's an insecurity in that. The Americans don't care. They're mildly enamored of the British accent, though in her book, Lynn Murphy takes that apart a little bit as well. She documents that no, Americans do not think that you're more intelligent just because you have a British accent.
Quite right, too.
This defensiveness on the part of the Brits, which has a certain parallel with French, that the American language choices have to be shut out, that British English is under attack. That's a very defensive position, and it indicates a lack of belief in the robustness of British English.
Is it a relic of empire that we as a nation, we're constantly seeing how we're becoming ever more humble, ever less relevant, and therefore we become protective of our language as a sort of last bastion of English achievement?
Yeah, I think so. There's a sense of ownership that's being protected. The irony is that one of the great successes of the empire was the export of the language. So it's an achievement. It shouldn't be seen as a threat.
Yeah, it struck me reading your piece, Lionel, that it is very much like the French thing, isn't it? Like they have the Académie Française, which is supposed to sort of guard the so-called purity of the French language. But it seems to me strange that English should behave like this, because it's such a hybrid thing anyway.
Well, it's the nature of the language.
Yeah.
It's what has made it a great language. And so that defensiveness, that keeping other words out and keeping change out, it's antithetical to the nature of the language and why the language has been so successful. It's the absorbent quality of English. I mean, it has the largest vocabulary of any language in the world, and it keeps going up. I mean, the OED can barely keep up with all the additions.
Do you feel that there is really a clear distinction between American English and British English? Because apart from some sort of variant spellings, you could make an argument that everyone is speaking the same language. There's no real distinction to be drawn.
Well, I would say that there are still some differences. You go to the supermarket, whereas, of course, the Americans would go to a grocery store, and you still get a trolley. You do not get a cart. You still get your rubbish collected instead of your trash.
But, yeah.
Though I've noticed the word trash is making inroads.
Well, trash is a Shakespearean word, isn't it? So, I mean, like all these things, there's a pedigree to it, all of them, I imagine.
Yeah. You know, that said, that there are still some distinctions, and there's some expressions you simply wouldn't hear in the United States and vice versa. They are mashing up.
Yeah.
Okay? And that process has been sped up enormously by television. I think television far more even than film. Television, we're watching each other's TV.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, this whole box set phenomenon, The Wire being imported over here, The Sopranos. But, you know, it also works the other direction. I mean, the Americans were watching Night Manager.
Yeah, Downton Abbey, I suppose, which is a...
Oh, absolutely.
So we don't really talk like Downton Abbey anymore.
No.
If we ever did.
Well, yeah, that's a good point.
Thank God.
One of the things that I was getting at the piece I wrote for the TLS is that this has become a big professional frustration for me, because my publishers, HarperCollins, are very leery of any invasions of British English into my work. And they got this into their heads quite some time ago, that this was the problem with my books. And therefore, they tell all my copy editors that, you know, Shriver uses Britishisms that have to be expunged. The problem is that they're using, you know, 22-year-old, just out of university copy editors, because those are the only people who will work for no money. And their vocabularies have not reached maturity, let's just put it that way. And so every word they encounter that they don't know, instead of looking it up, they just decide it's a British usage and has to go. And so I end up lavishing hours on copy editing, going online and documenting the etymology of all these, you know, often just very American word choices, or at least words that are shared and commonplace between both countries.
You give a great example of that, where pica, which I thought did sound like a sort of Cockney word from the 17th century, comes from California.
Well, it's from the gold rush.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, it couldn't be more American.
I'm interested, why don't they want, because you're an author who is American but has lived a long time in England. Why, as a publishing house, don't they want to hear you talking in a vocabulary rich in the language of both nations? Why would they want to preserve you in the aspic of Americanness?
Well, I mean, I will at least defend them on the point that when I'm sending a book in the United States, then the American characters, for the most part, should probably be using American usage. I mean, they shouldn't be getting a shopping trolley, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
So, you know, I'm on side with that. But what with all this miscegenation of our lingo going on, and it is happening apace. My characters are the only characters in the United States who can't say spot on.
Because what? It sounds too British.
Because you know, I'm having my ear contaminated. But meanwhile, all the other writers can pick up these expressions. I mean, I see this in you know, op-eds and all the time. People have started saying at the end of the day, they'll call something, a political idea, dodgy or dicey. Yeah. And they think it's incredibly snappy, right?
It's incredibly
snappy. I'm not allowed to use these words.
But what about in your narrative? Because leaving aside, if you're writing American characters, they should speak, I suppose, a recognisably American idiolect. But your narrative voice, Lionel, do you feel that has changed over the years you've lived in Britain? Do you feel that you speak with different terms in at the front of your mind?
Well, I try to be able to change channels.
Okay.
And that's especially the case writing with fiction. That's less the case with nonfiction, and I do allow myself to use British language if I want to, because, I mean, I've been here for 30 years.
Yeah.
So I think I've earned it. You know, when you live that long around a set of word choices, then they get into your head.
Yeah.
But when I'm writing fiction that's set in the U.S., then I try to just change that channel and think in American.
Are there any hills you want to die on in terms of Americanisms you'd keep, the aluminum versus aluminium? Or the one I'm always struck by in American, they say they could care less when they mean they couldn't care less. That seems to be a split. That
well,
is,
actually, that's exactly the kind of thing that the author of this book points out is a problem in both cultures.
Okay, what's the outcome? What does she say? That's
that both Americans and Brits make the same mistake.
Oh, it's just the same. And
you know, that's a very British assumption, that because it's wrong, it must be American.
Well, yeah, although I'm not sure I've ever heard a non-American say.
Really?
Well, I don't know. But maybe you're right.
I have.
Have you? Okay, well, yeah. This is my horrible colonialist attitude that I didn't think I possessed coming up without me realising.
You've exposed me.
It's in your DNA.
I know, apparently. This sounds like a fun book. Is this a worthwhile read? Because not every book we discuss, you can often have interesting discussions about not very good books, but this feels like a book that's probably worth everyone going to track down and find and read.
If these are issues that interest you, this is the book to read. What I like about it is that it defies your expectations. And usually this kind of book is, as I note in the review, really lightweight. It's often what people do. They've come over as, say, a spouse of somebody, it's always an American, right? Needs something to do, spends 6 months to a year in Britain and writes a sprightly account of all the quaint differences between the two cultures, including the language differences.
Yeah.
This is not that book. This is much more studious, although written with a sense of mischief.
Yeah.
So, and it's very well written, I should qualify. So it's entertaining, but it's got some substance. And it's not out to flatter the Brits.
Quite right.
That kind of lightweight thing that I'm talking about is always fawning at
its
core. And it's always about trying to belong, and it's always about, you know, showing how much you've noticed and how you've, you've become one of the locals and you really understand them. And it's just, Yeah, I'm sure for the British audience it completely backfires, and it's only faintly interesting to the American audience. This one, I think, is much more written for the Brits, because it is out to discourage the British from feeling superior, from adopting that defensive and paranoid stance in relation to Americans, and it undermines all of their assumptions about where different expressions come from.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good recommendation.
Serves us right,
yes,
no
yeah.
doubt.
Goddamn Brits.
Lionel, yeah, it's a good read.
It's a good read, really
enjoyable.
As is your piece, Lionel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Have you ever heard a non-American say could care less?
I don't think I've ever heard anyone say could care less.
It's me, then. It might be just my prejudices.
You've met one person who said it and got all cross.
I love it. I bow to nobody in my love for America and its language and its authors and its sports and its beers. And so I'm the last person to be sniffy about America.
Yeah, no, I don't understand the attitude that tries to defend any language from any other bits coming in. It's an odd attitude and totally pointless.
Particularly as English is basically a mix of Latin,
hybrid.
French,
yeah, exactly.
And
it's a hybrid
Norwegian
from the beginning. Yeah.
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 Aren't we sensible?
Aren't we marvellous? Yeah, even though we're British.
Yeah.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Simon Leys, born Pierre Reitman to a great Belgian family in 1935, was a renowned figure of cultural cross-pollination. He felt the pull of wandering travel from a young age. Ever the lot, he thought, of people born in small countries who inherit less nourishing cultures and graze on their neighbours' richer pastures. An accomplished seaman, he found himself at the age of 19 in the China of the Cultural Revolution. He fell instantly in love with China, its people and its culture, and after a bumpy start, married a Chinese Catholic woman. His proximity to Maoism made him a fervent critic and a notable polemicist against much of the Western pro-Mao fervour of the period. In David Coward's review of Philippe Paquet's biography, we get the sense of the man, his silky writing skills, his determination to testify journalistically to overlooked outrages. Coward's final summation makes you surely want to hear more about someone who is a mixture of Don Quixote, George Orwell, Mother Teresa and Confucius. Well, you're in luck, because David Coward joins Lucy and me now. David, hello.
Hello.
How well known is Simon Leys now? He died in 2016. How much is he familiar to people?
Well, I think he's very well known in Chinese studies circles, but I think in France his reputation is rather variegated. Some people admire what he did, but a lot of them, of course, still rather begrudge the fact that he took the wind out of the sails of the intellectual movement post-1968 in France.
Well, let's explain how he got so interested in China, because there was nothing necessarily in his background that would have led him to that. Well, how did he end up an expert in China?
Well, he he embarked on a varied course of university studies, part of which was Chinese studies, and he managed to get a grant that took him to the Far East, and immediately fell in love with the place. He tended to regard it as a kind of not as a place, but more as a state of mind. And his vision of China really was one of the great Chinese cultural tradition, which he thought in the mid 50s, when China was being reconstructed, that everything was going well. But when he moved to the Far East, first to Singapore and then to Hong Kong, he could read the local newspapers, and he saw the bodies floating down the river, and he suddenly got a vision that Mao's China had gone terribly wrong somewhere.
And you call him the man who did for Mao. In France and Europe at the time, was everyone still very much on the Mao bandwagon?
After 1968, there was a tremendous movement that was, I suppose, utopian in nature. It was a time when Saint-Germain rang with, because lots of little factories and workshops in Saint-Germain at the time, which were knocking out new literary theories every 10 minutes or so. They've all sort of gone away now, but in the 1970s, it was all happening. Everybody was very cross with the right, and there was a gang that centered on the magazine Tel Quel, people like Kristeva and Solers and Barthes. And Sartre, of course, joined in. He thought that Mao's revolution was going to bring about the new vision of the East, the new world of the East, whereas Lays soon realized that Mao's cultural revolution wasn't particularly cultural at all, nor was it a revolution. It was, in fact, an out-and-out land grab, and the whole fabric of China, to his sense, the culture of China, the cultural tradition of China, was being ruined by these people who had come along and decided that the world should be changed according to their view of things. Now, in France and in Europe generally, people tended to think that Mao Zedong was a good thing. But in fact, Simon Leys showed, he kept a diary of what he'd seen when he was living in Hong Kong. He published it as The Emperor's New Clothes, and it was the first of a couple of volumes in which he exposed what was really going on in China, the deaths, the forced labor camps and the rest of it, the uprooting of the whole of the middle class who were sent to improve themselves in country areas and learn new skills and so on. He exposed the whole sham. And when Tel Quel and the and its members paid a visit to China in April 1974, they soon realized that their view of it was quite wrong and that Simon Leys was quite right. And they went rather quiet after that.
Did they? They didn't admit to it at the time, did they? They didn't say, oh, you were right, actually there's more to this than...
No, they didn't. No, they didn't care for him at all.
No, that's what I mean, thought.
At one point he applied for a job in a Paris university and he was really blacklisted, I suppose.
I think it's difficult for us in Britain to understand how important Sartre was as well. But he was a huge figure, wasn't he? So it was very, very unfashionable to say, no, he doesn't know what he's talking about, this is wrong.
He thought Sartre was a windbag.
Yes, but, I don't suppose there was anyone else saying that at the time.
There were a few others. After the war, there was a little group of right-wing writers who objected to the fact that French culture had been annexed by the left.
And
certainly there was one very interesting man, Claude Roy, who was a poet and cultural observer. I mean, he thought that Simon Leys had got it absolutely spot on. So he did have defenders, but of course the fashionable people who always occupy the moral high ground, they had the loudest voices and the best ways of expressing what they had to say.
And I have read somewhere that there are people who try to defend that position now by saying that, well, they were wrong about Mao, because obviously there was a huge amount of suffering and death and famine and cruelty and all sorts of things, but that it made them think about human rights and the situation of the workers and things like that. That was what got Sartre engagé And so then actually they looked at what France was doing and what was happening in France and in other places, and so they argue that things got better.
So by misunderstanding what was going on with Mao in China, they profitably considered what was going on in France.
Well, it made them think about people and workers and rights. And I mean, I'm not saying this is not my line, but this is a defence that has been used.
Well, I mean, one of the telco group, Kisteva, wrote a book about Chinese women. And she made them out to be heroines, as you say, of a new kind of utopia. I think that the real change came after the death of Mao, and then there was the Gang of Four. There was a lot of squabbling and politicking. And then, you know, Deng's reconstruction, his reforms kicked in. And I think it's sort of, it's gone on from there. I mean, China continued to be a very closed society for a very long time. And it's only recently, I suppose, that with the embracing of the liberal market, free market economy within limits, that China really has rejoined the community of nations.
He ends up in Australia in the 70s, doesn't he, as a professor. But what other areas of intellectual dispute and debate did he get into? He had a row with Christopher Hitchens about Christopher's negative view of Mother Teresa.
Yeah, that's right. Simon Les was a Catholic, a devout Catholic, and he took umbrage. I think he got very cross with Christopher Hitchens for being rude about Mother Teresa. But I think they fought it to a draw, really. They both respected each other because they both thought each other were very clever.
And what sort of academic was he? Did he have an ideal of what an academic thinker should be?
Oh, yes. And that was one very odd, to my mind, side of his character. He was a very idealistic man. His ideal was that of the gentleman of Confucius, who is belongs not to the social elite, not gentleman in that sense, but one who belongs to the moral and intellectualist elite, one who thinks that thought and right and justice are quite important things.
Is that a terrible thing for an academic to cherish?
Well, the way in which he tried to translate that into some sort of reality was, I mean, for example, in his attitude towards translation, he thought that translation ought not to be done for money, and there should be no hurry about it, and it should be done as perfectly as possible. And his idea of the university would be a place where sagacious teachers welcomed willing and inquiring students into an environment, I don't know, buildings were never mentioned, where the students learned what their elders taught them. There was no courses, there were no fees, there were no examinations.
So was he a bit of an elitist, do you think, David, in some ways? It sounds a bit rarefied.
I think so, I think he got into. He wasn't very popular in certain university circles in Australia, and he took early retirement because he didn't really like the way in which modern universities were going. And in fact, I suppose you could see that he wasn't the only one.
No. After you've read this book and with what you know about him, David, are you fond of him? Do you feel fondness at the end of this book?
Well, I think he was a very austere man. His standards were very high, and he lived up to them himself. But I think I don't think would be able to live up to the kind of standards that he required.
But I suppose it's an achievement of sorts, him managing to do it for himself.
Oh, yes, I think so. And he did it very well because he took a very moral view of his love of China and he made it stick.
Well, it's a fascinating piece and a fascinating man. David Carr, thank you very much.
Well, can I just say one more thing about the translation is absolutely superb. I think that Simon Les would very much approve of the translation,
which is by Julie Rose. I should have said that at the beginning.
It's so important, really, the translation. I was just reading a review of a book by Marcel Pagnol, which was translated. You know, he wrote Jean de Florette and so on, and it came out in the early 60s, and it was translated just worryingly inadequately. reviewer in the Times' verdict on it. And I think as a result, Pagnol's reputation as a writer of prose has suffered in the English-speaking world. I mean, so that a translator really has the reputation of a writer in his or her hands.
And that's an opinion probably Simone Leys would agree with.
Mm. Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
Because I think it's quite right.
Yeah. David, thank you very much.
Okay,
Take care.
You very much. Thank Bye-bye.
You.
It's quite right. We should actually always, we do this, but when we talk about books, we should always say translated
yes,
by,
yeah.
And it's Julie Rose, and that's for David Coward, who's...
who is himself a wonderful translator.
Yeah, to say that that's a fine translation is quite a thing, isn't it?
Yes, and as he says, that will be of paramount importance to Simone Leys, whether it was well done.
And that's almost all we have time for today. We'll shortly hear Kate Bingham read her poem, published this week in the TLS, called This Hair. Before that, let me thank David Coward and Lionel Shriver, and of course, you, Lucy.
Thank you for having me.
Did you have fun?
I did, of course.
Do not you, Lucy, find yourself a copy of the TLS or subscribe online. This week we have stuff on Shakespeare, the Egyptian election and Baron von Richthofen, among much else. Next week, Lucy, I can leave this to you actually. What's the theme of the paper?
Am I really allowed to tell?
Yeah, and what do we have on the cover?
All right, well, the theme of the paper is graphic novels, I think we can say, and cartoons.
Comics. Yes.
I'm not going to say, I don't think I should say exactly what it is.
Okay.
But can I say the publication it's related to?
Yes.
It is related to the wonderful publication that is The Beano.
Which may or may not have contributed the cover image.
But let's leave everyone absolutely agog.
The notion of that.
Yeah.
The TLS and Beano mashup is barely a week away. We'll be talking about that here. But to end this week's show, we're joined by Kate Bingham to read what's a beautiful poem published in the paper. Kate, hello.
Hello there.
Tell us about this poem. It's a lovely thing. This Hair, it's called.
Absolutely. It's a poem that depends on the title, so it all hangs off that first title. It's one long sentence, and it started its life as a sonnet, but grew as hair does, into its own shape.
How lovely. Well, we're going to hear it now. Until next week, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.
This hair that used to be the colour of gold, spun gold, my mother said, that no one expected, my only distinguishing feature, gold that grew no matter what I did, and grew through me and made me good, a girl to have and hold from gold to ginger, sand to henna red, to this hot flush of wash-in pink shampoo, a long, rose-madder-tinted memory of hair that slowly grows, as I grow old, more precious. Every wiry hair I shed picked off my clothes with a sigh and said goodbye to, trailed through dust, or unceremoniously swept into landfill, hair my fingers fold in hairpin bends, or follow thread by thread, each line a thought of something not thought through, a daydream, scribbles in a diary of lost concentration, loose and cold at my elbow, handfuls of hair torn from my head, like some frustrated fine-tooth comb review of its own story, this limp fantasy, this hair I should have loved, though I was told it wouldn't last, hangs on, as soft and dead as ever, changed but changing, no less true than when its former beauty flattered me.